The question that we must ask ourselves as responsible people is, are the vital interests of the United States really threatened? Are the vital interests of the other power constellation in the world, led by Russia, really threatened? Is it really true that we must fight them on everything and that they must fight us on every issue? Or could it possibly be ascertained whether there aren't some vital interests of ours that are not threatened by the Russians, and some vital interests of theirs that are not threatened by us, so that we could proceed to compromise all of these non-vital issues, but hold fast on those that cannot be compromised without losing the values that we cherish most? I do not believe that this scheme has ever been tried, of finding out what our vital interests are and what the Russians' vital interests are. Surely, we can't say that the Dardanelles are our vital interests that we cannot compromise, or that the division of the spoils in Trieste is a vital interest of ours. Nor could the Russians possibly say that our relationship, let's say, with Hawaii or Samoa or some of the Pacific Islands or our Latin American neighbors are vital interests of theirs. I think a thoughtful examination of the situation in which we find ourselves vis-a-vis the Russians would reveal that there are many points on which we can negotiate and compromise without undermining the essential ingredients of our way of life, and that they too can negotiate and compromise on many issues which will not undermine their particular system. Of course, you may say, you can't trust the Russians. Perhaps we can. We did trust them for a while, and for the time being, our trust was not too seriously abused. They may say they cannot trust us either. And what answer do we have to that? But what I am saying is what, of course, makes a person nowadays suspect. It makes one suspect of being an appeaser. And I want to reaffirm here and now, lest I be misunderstood, that I would not appease the Russians on any vital interest of ours. And I don't expect them to appease us on any vital interest of theirs. But what we have been arguing so far as I'm able to see, is not altogether a question of our vital interest. This leads me to raise the question to what our needs are and what our problems are that have been deferred and postponed, and only partway met so far under these adverse circumstances. They are obviously the problems of an ongoing society, and the needs that have been inculcated into us by living in a closely knit democratic world in which the advantages of some soon are translated into appetites by all. If it were merely meeting the physical needs of man, I think we probably could reduce our budget enormously. It's been estimated that most of us could live on a decent, nutritive diet for probably less than 25 cents a day. But nobody would want to eat the stuff. And certainly no one would want to come to the dinner table to have a ceremony about devouring it. But that is not obviously what we want. We want the kind of diet that is attractive that we have been led to believe is desirable, that has been advertised as fascinating, and that has made eating something of a pleasure. When the kids around the dinner table at home in my grandfather's day used to be pretty ravenous, he used to say to us, to halt us back in our appetite, that we don't live to eat. We eat to live. Well, that, I think, was half a fallacy. We also live to eat. And it is this social definition of our needs that counts, rather than the mere physiological definition that matters. Our needs are all those things which we have come to recognize as unsolved problems. And so it is with many other things. So it is with housing and medical care and the general welfare. What about our housing? The American people, as a rule, live in some kind of shelter which is better than that of caveman. People have lived in caves and trenches and huts and igloos and have survived. And they didn't have a housing problem. But they have a housing problem today when we know how to create housing of a quality and a standard that we think is fit for man in our age. Therefore, an advancing civilization inevitably expands the horizon of dissatisfaction. And it is upon that dynamic that our society has grown and flourished. If that ever stopped, you could close your schools of journalism and your advertising agencies and a lot of other institutions that we now support to create the kind of discontent, the kind of problems which will urge men to seek rational or non-rational satisfaction. As we look around the country, what are some of these crucial problems? Well, for the time being, we certainly are still in the stage where even the problems of health have been set back immeasurably by an organized medical lobby that parades under the most pious disguises. We find ourselves confronted by an organization that is spending large sums of money, one of the largest lobbies in the country, one of the most affluent, for the purpose, in a short-sighted, I think, and thoroughly unprofessional manner, utterly unworthy of the profession, holding back an arrangement for the improvement of the health through the medical care of the American people. How long we shall be stymied in that progress, which is necessary to realize our resources to the utmost and to prevent the stunting and crippling of life and talent and order and a decent society, no one can predict. But I think it will last as long as the people of the country do not understand what is going on about them. There is no question about the fact that perhaps our medical care is better today than it was 10 years ago or 50 years ago or 100 years ago, and that perhaps the poorest individual has better medical care than he had then. But that is not the point. The point is that the great potentialities of science and the advance in medical technology is not being distributed to all in accordance with the possibilities and the needs. And the same thing is true of housing. Here we have an effort made in a stumbling sort of way to eradicate the slums of our great cities and of the countryside. And what do we find? The short-sighted people whose own mistaken self-interest leads them to think that any governmental intervention in housing is bad, block the most promising aspect of the development in this field because they do not understand what they are about. When I tell my friends in the real estate business that they're cutting their own throat, they say they must simply stop this trend toward public subsidy. And then when I point out to them that if it weren't for these public subsidies, they would all be out of business, they're astonished. In my city, in Chicago, I have seen almost no housing go up in the last 10 years, which was not in one way or another publicly subsidized. Publicly subsidized through governmental loans, insurance of loans, aid to building and loan associations in various ways, and many other devices that are too remote to be discussed here. There wouldn't have been any housing at all, private or public, if it had not been for these various forms of governmental intervention. And yet, these very same people, in their stupor, fail to see that they are blocking the next great advance in the improvement of the manner and level of life of our people, and are, in a way, crippling the very private enterprise that they seem to feel is threatened. They are crippling it because if all of these various forms of governmental aid were withdrawn, there wouldn't be anything going on in the private field. What would happen, imagine, if we suddenly canceled all the deposit insurance in the savings bank? If we canceled all the insurance of the building and loan associations, which they enjoy equally with the savings bank? If we fail to give the kind of loans which now make it possible for a man with the investment of $100,000 or less to undertake a project worth $1 million. Obviously, enterprise would be completely paralyzed. We have arrived at a point nowadays where some people feel that government ought to take all of the risk and ought to turn over the profits to a private entrepreneur whose only justification for claiming profits is that he does take some risk. Since I'm speaking in an area surrounded by farms, I might say that the same problem holds in the agricultural field as well. And I am not against agricultural subsidies, although I think they could be rationalized and made more consistent with a sound national policy than they now are. For every problem that we face, whether it be housing or medical care, we find an organized group within our own society exerting pressure to the utmost, and often in a most suicidal and unrational manner, to block the efforts at progress. What is true in the case of health, housing, is of course equally true, though we don't often suspect it, in the field of education. The hope for the equalization of opportunity in education on the part of all of our people, and for developing each to the maximum of his talent, is frustrated not so much by organized opposition to educational appropriation, but to minor quarrels within the country, especially the tying up of the problem of education with religion in the face of our tradition of the separation of church and state. And yet it is a fact that this fission within our society at the present moment seems to block a rational nationwide program that would have immense benefit for all. The same thing is true, of course, in the field of welfare. I think we ought to see, if we look at these problems in the light of our resources and in the light of our possibilities, that unless they are met, and met promptly, in the domestic field, we will be losing one of the great magnets which draws people elsewhere in the world to an appreciation of this system of a free society and a semi-free economy, because it's never really been free, not from its very beginning, either.